June 27th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for listening to RBN. To see the lineup for Studio A and B, please click on the word schedule in the RBN banner at the top of the page at republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest schedule for this program, please visit the radio schedule page at spingola.com, where you will see a list of the guests together with links to their websites. Feel free to join my email list to receive a weekly announcement of the scheduled guest and any other special notices. I have linked it to today's date. For questions or comments during the program, email spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna@spingola.com, which I do not access during the program. A couple of things. I've had a hard time not bursting out laughing. Someone is having a bit of fun with us and has posted a story saying that today Congress passed a bipartisan bill requiring Americans to add Israel's Star of David to the U.S. flag for the week of July 4th. And they even say that Representative Hugh Llewellyn of Alabama and Senator Dale Wentworth of New Jersey introduced the legislation during a special session, and citizens who own American flags should proceed to their nearest post office to receive the free Star of David patch, which includes a convenient flag-ready Velcro backing. Well, obviously, I called my local post office. Well, first I went to the website that that was announcing this. It wasn't official, and I scrolled down to the bottom, and it was a website that everybody seems to be using to post their blog. And anyway, I called my local post office and asked the guy about it. And he and I had a very good laugh. So anyway, if somebody emails you this news of this, even though it sounds reasonable and it sounds believable, it just isn't true. My second thing. More than a year ago, one of our listeners suggested that I get Ed Chiarini on my radio program. I responded in the negative as I did not believe that his information is credible. Apparently, he just added me to his page and is attempting to say that Victoria Jackson of SNL and I am the same person. Then he has an audio of me and this Jackson person, which are clearly not the same person. And I wonder if this has anything to do with some of the information that I present on this program. These two instances certainly prove that you cannot believe everything that you read on the internet and that you have to use critical thinking skills and open your eyes and your ears and just kind of figure things out. So anyway, I mentioned to a friend that I was going to mention this on my radio program, and he Skyped back, and he said that you really are Victoria Jackson, and that's why I was kind of laughing when I when I came on, because it's ridiculous. Anyway, my guest today is Carl Rattle, and he is the author of Communism and the Jews, a Source Reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com, and we will take calls in the second hour after the first break at 800-313-9443. Carl, are you with us?
I am.
Well, how are you today?
Oh, I'm pretty good. That was a pretty good start to a program, I have to say.
I listened to an audio of me and an audio of this other lady, and I thought, where does he come up? Where does he get this stuff? And yet there will be people who will probably believe it.
Oh, yeah.
Funny. Alrighty, we do have to go to a quick break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
Hey, meat eaters, the freeze-dried guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dried guy. Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The Freeze-Dry Guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes six number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every Meat Eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus Meat Eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the Freeze Dry Guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
Chlorine, fluoride, pathogens, and more are in the water you drink day to day. Do you want the ability to remove and reduce those harmful things in the water you drink? You can. How? With a Berkey water filter. A complete standalone gravity filter system that requires no electricity and no plumbing. Use for emergencies or for every day. Berkey systems come in 7 different sizes. Where can you get one? From GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com. With the purchase of each system, you get 50% off accessories, such as fluoride filters, water level spigot, and sport bottles. Plus, free shipping on all orders over $25. For a limited time, get 5% off all ceramic systems when you use coupon code RBN. Call GetBerkey at 855-GetBerkey. That's 855-438-2375. Or visit GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com.
Don't answer it! How can I stop these annoying collection calls?
Imagine being free from your debt without settling and with no payment plans, no negotiating or filing bankruptcy, and no attorneys. What if you could eliminate the risk from all your unsecured debt in about 90 days and keep all your money? You can! It's called Zero Debt Guarantee, and it works. There's no other program of its kind on the planet, and we guarantee the results in writing. Call now, 800-477-9256. Let our team of experts provide you with the resources to fight back, stop collection calls, and prevent and stop wage garnishments and bank levies. If you're facing foreclosure, we can help. Don't go it alone. Get free information now by calling 800-477-9256. Talk to an expert who has also completed our program. Call 800-477-9256 for free info. Or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com. That's 800-477-9256. Or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com.
All righty, we are back. And our guest today is Carl Radl, R-A-D-L. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. And, you know, it's amazing that when people speak out against a certain ethnic group, that they immediately become the target of those who are who like to promote the Nazis did this and the Nazis did that. And if anybody speaks out telling the truth, then you immediately become a target for all kinds of ridiculous things.
I think the latest one they've come up with is the what they call the Arab lobby. They have this Mitchell Bard, if anyone's ever heard of him. He's the former editor of the Israeli Quarterly Review or something, or the American Quarterly Review. It's a paper or journal sponsored by AIPAC. He's actually Jewish, despite the name. He came up with a conspiracy theory called the Arab lobby, where he argues against Mearsheimer and Walt in exactly the same terms as they use against the Jews. He says that there's an Arab conspiracy against Israel, you know, they're using their money to promote Islam in the US, and it's the whole, you know, the whole thing. And then they turn around and say, you're a conspiracy theorist. Hang on a minute.
Isn't that funny? You know,
they don't know throughout history, though. That's the thing.
Certainly. Yes. I wrote back to my friend. I said, further, I do not have a double chin and zits on my face, nor do I wear makeup, the kind that one smears on their skin. I wear a bit of lipstick, and since I don't have much of a brow line, I use an eyebrow pencil and some mascara to darken my lashes. I don't have time for all of that other garbage. Oh, my gosh, is this not just like a female to cite all of these details? And it's true.
I wouldn't have even noticed that. That's the thing. I've just gone, okay, well, not the same person. Bye.
Okay. I guess we better talk about some serious things now.
Yeah, I was going to actually bring something up for you. As I'm doing a Spingola special after this, I was going to say that something I came up with when I was doing some research on Damascus 1840 was a little number that we know very well called 6 million. And that was being used in 1840 at Damascus.
Really? Early?
That early. They were using the claim that, was it Adolf Kamiur actually said when he got the Sultan to drop the charges against the Jews in the ritual murder case, that you are doing this on behalf of 6 million Jews. And the cited reasoning being that there are 6 million Jews in the world. And you look at it and you just think, how does this number keep appearing? There are, you know, if it's as early as 1840, I suspect there's other references to it before that.
Because
it came in the 1880s. It may just be an independent reference, I don't know. But it was just something that caught my eye when I was looking at, when I was reading some of the literature on the subject. It's that the constant mention of 6 million.
How interesting. And of course it was, it's in the Talmud or somewhere in their religious books, and so it is a kind of a religious number that they have to substantiate with some kind of catastrophe. But it's very interesting to hear it mentioned that early in 1840.
Yeah,
to officialize it and give it credibility in 1840.
Yeah, which is quite it's a very, very early time for it to appear. And I don't think anyone's ever actually noticed that that's been used. I think partially because the Damascus affair has been sort of lost to history, and most people after 1945 didn't really pay attention to it.
Sure.
There you go. Such is life, I think.
Right. And it's really important, as you have indicated, that it's important that we look at history. Because if we don't, well, we just miss a lot of stuff. And we can't make comparisons to what's going on today.
Yes, because in order to make comparison that's going on today, you have to show that the historical example has applicability. So you can use history to prove anything, literally, because you can always find a historical example or a historical theory to suit your taste. And that's one of the big problems people have, is that they kind of get lost in all these different theories and they kind of lose the wood from the trees. So you have to kind of take it back to, well, okay, let's get back to basics here a bit, rather than let's get into all the isms, phobias, the different historical schools and what have you. It's not a good thing to get into unless you're really, really interested in history, in which case you can read about it. But most people, I think just get horribly confused when people start talking of imperialism, but yet five different authors will mean five different things by the subject.
Sure. Now, you have done a very, very thorough examination of the protocols of the learned, or as some people say, lurid elders of Zion.
Lurid? I haven't heard that one before.
But it does kind of match. I mean, sort of, if you look at some activities, behaviors.
Well, I think it's just the protocols with one of these things. It's one of these things that gets overstated. It's not the skeleton key for Jews or their activities. I mean, what it is, as far as I can make out, is a document that comes from Zionist circles, probably extreme ones, in a very specific window of time, that it indicates more what the kind of these people were thinking. And if you compare it to the Judenstadt, which I'm going to be doing, then you can begin to then compare that, what those two documents say, against what the Jews have done in the modern times. So you can sort of say, well, okay, well, the protocols and the Judenstadt agree. So if we then look at Israel and Israel's doing it, or the diaspora is doing it, then we can actually say, okay, well, the protocols here are actually based on reality, because although they're a very general document, at the same time, they are also a very useful document if you kind of, if you remove all the layers upon layers of myths, nonsense, and just outright weird claims made by both sides in the debate. I think the key point to bring out is that the protocols, as I've said, do come from a very specific period of time. That's from late 1901 to September 1903. As I've said, have the only direct parallels to the original text come from Herzl's The Judenstaat, which was published, I believe, in 1896, and that those parallels come from a German edition of the Judenstaat. They don't come from a Russian edition. And that means that whoever was doing it knew German, and that was very strange for a Russian nationalist to be doing. Why on earth would they use a German edition when there was a Russian edition relatively easily available? And also you've got the issue of the Ukrainisms, which rule out the publisher of the protocols, Pavlov Krushivan, from contention. Plus, as I've said, that period is an interesting one precisely because you've got the All-Russian Zionist Congress in September 1902, and on which you've got the Kishinev pogrom, which occurs in April 1903, and from that time, we know that people from the Kishinev area went to that Zionist Congress, and that you had Kishinev happen in 1903, and of course you've got the Pavlov Krushivan connection, because Krushivan was the publisher of the newspaper, the Bezrabian, that was primarily involved in the pogroms, in promoting them, that kind of attitude. But at the same time, it wasn't immediately published afterwards, so it kind of begs the question, where did they come from? And also the question of why did they come with the backstory that they came with, which, as I've elaborated, is probably a way to, because you're going to avoid being prosecuted for encouraging people just to raid Jewish houses, because that was one of the activities that was most done. It wasn't so much a case of killing and raping. It was more a question of pillaging, but that was going on in Kishinev. Now, if you combine that Kishinev issue with the fact that the morning after the Kishinev pogrom started, a very interesting character turned up in history, Zeev Jabotinsky, the founder of Revisionist Zionism. He walked into a meeting the day after Kishinev in Odessa, which is nearby, and as I said, a major Jewish center, and also a major center of Zionist thought. And he began advocating Jewish defense committees and various extreme methods for dealing with what he saw as the opponents of the Jews. And those ideas, later formed the basis for an awful lot of the Zionist activities from the 1930s to 1948-49 up till probably quite fairly recently, if not to this day in Israel. For example, Netanyahu is a revisionist Zionist of a sort. He's not as hard line as many, but he's pretty close to being sort of, you know, we don't care what happens to the rest of the world as long as the Jews survive, because the Jews are the chosen people, that logic. And the fact that Jabotinsky appears at this time, and then we have the rise of an extreme form of Zionism in the same area as where the protocols probably come from, tells us that we are probably dealing with a Zionist document. Precisely because that's the only, it's very hard to see an anti-Jewish author making use of that edition, plus Old Testament references from a Latin Bible, plus, you know, putting Ukrainians in the text and managing to fool Krushivan into thinking it was an original document. It doesn't make sense.
Carl, we do have to go to a break, but I think it's very interesting that they used this pogrom in plays in New York that were being seen in New York, and they really pushed this and promoted it. And I believe they, of course, they politicized it, but I wonder if they didn't just kind of start it themselves. So I think that's something that would be kind of interesting to look into. All righty, we will be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors.
As business becomes more difficult, control of cash and the ability to borrow becomes critical. Working capital cash is your greatest insurance and guarantee of financial stability in these uncertain times. Equipment leasing allows you to obtain the income-producing equipment that your business needs and pay for it with tax-free, ever-devaluing dollars. Money that you've already earned and paid taxes on should be sparingly used. That is your reserve capital, safety net. We are also able to buy and lease back equipment that you already own and have depreciated, thereby making more cash available for your present-day needs. For a complete, comprehensive explanation as to how this financial truth will benefit your business future, call Bob New Incorporated at 888-639-2621. 888-639-2621. Keep your working capital cash reserves and borrowing capability. 888-639-2621.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Do you flinch when a police car appears in your rearview mirror or you get pulled over? Are you squeamish when an envelope arrives in the mail with a return address of a court, a government agency like the IRS, or some law firm? Would you like to escape government agency harassment? Then visit escapeharassment.com. George Bush allegedly says, "The government constitution is nothing but a doggone piece of paper." Well, that's a contract. A contract is an offer acceptance of that offer, at which point a contract arises by law and the offeror can no longer withdraw the offer. We teach, do not accept. That way there is no contract or agreement for you to go to their court or private club meeting. To escape government agency harassment like the IRS, visit escapeharassment.com. This is a tried and proven experienced process, not experimental, with a money-back guarantee that it works and success testimonials from previous students. Remember, escapeharassment.com. That's escapeharassment.com.
Carl Rattle, the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com, and I recommend that you go there and read his multi-part article on the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. Yes, okay, what do you think about the pogrom being initiated or at least started or provoked by the Jews themselves?
Well, I'd say more provoked than started. I mean, there's been an awful lot of work done on the Kishinev pogrom because of it's so famous.
Right.
But it more or less started because the local Jews had for a long time been in a very privileged position. This is one of the myths of Jewish history, is that particularly in relation to Zionism, is the fact that that the Jew has been this kind of, should we say, a passive figure, a cowardly figure, has not been central, been kind of poor, you know, been persecuted all the time. And that just isn't true. To be sure, there were Jews like that, and there always will be Jews like that, but quite a lot of Jews did quite well. A good example is the fact that an Israeli academic, I think I mentioned this before, but an Israeli academic fairly recently published a book in Hebrew about the Ukrainian, the structure of the Ukrainian Jewry in about the 18th, 19th centuries. And he made the shocking conclusion, and quite a revolutionary argument in some respects, that actually the Jews in the Ukraine, during this time, were an incredibly powerful group because of the fact that they were the tax farmers. They were, have historically been the tax farmers in many different civilizations, from Islamic to Western Europe to Eastern Europe, and that they exerted an awful lot of power over the people. Because what they did was they would have, they would buy the tax rights from the local lords, who would, for a certain amount of money, and per the usual tax farming regulations, they would then try to recoup as much as they could of that. So it was up to them whether they made a profit or not, and so it's in their interest to tax people to the maximum possible advantage, and to work from there. In addition to that, he concluded that the Jews were actually worse tax farmers in some of, in that they were more, they went for higher profits and that kind of thing, than their Gentile equivalents, either the Poles, the Ukrainians, or I think it was Germans he wanted to compare them to. And this research actually tells us what was going, to an extent, what was going on at Kishinev, because we have a history in Ukraine with the Chmielnicki pogrom of the early 17th century. I think it's 1615, possibly, or 1618, 1619, I can't remember which, where historically Jews have referred to that as the Shoah, not the Holocaust. That's before the Holocaust, that was the Shoah.
Oh.
Because that was when, the Shoah literally means, all it means is catastrophe, and there's been numerous Shoah events. That was the big one for them before the Holocaust. Basically, the logic was that the Jews were particularly persecuted in it by these evil Cossacks led by a man, Cossacks and Ukrainian nationalists led by Chmielnicki, who was himself a Cossack. Recent research, however, has proven that Chmielnicki didn't go after the Jews in particular. He went after the tax collectors. And it just so happens, a bit like Stalin, I might add, in 1948 to 1953, that a lot of the people he was going after happened to be Jewish. So the Jews naturally interpreted that as being anti-Semitic, being a conspiracy against them. And this came down as received opinion in their history until quite recently, when people started to compare the casualty lists and who was targeted and the literature around it. And they found out, no, that wasn't actually true at all. It was just the idea that, so it had been a received opinion in the Jewish community for so long that no one had really questioned that that was the case. And the case
with regard to Stalin going after them?
Stalin going after them? Well, again, it's a case of, you have to understand context. Stalin's attack on the Jews in 1948 to 1959 was rationalized in terms of ruthless cosmopolitans, and in part was caused by the Jews who themselves had been allying with Zionism during the war, and had become rather infatuated with Zionism, as of all, a lot of the intellectuals had anyway. And as early in the 1920s, for example, one Jewish intellectual, one Stalin's intellectual, actually had the gall to tell Stalin that they didn't want Belobijan, which is the Siberian Zionist project of the Soviet Union, when they were going to create a Jewish SSR, Soviet Socialist Republic, in Siberia for them. Said we don't want that. We want the Crimea because we don't want to have to work hard to get to, you know, to build a Jewish state because we contributed so much to Bolshevism. That
right.
Didn't go down.
And
well.
Of course, it was already settled, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't like they had to go in and totally, build up the land. I mean, it was kind of settled anyway.
It was settled to a degree. There was an awful lot of, shall we say, possibilities there. For building a state and that kind of thing, but the Jews didn't want that. they wanted somewhere they could. It would be much easier for them.
Right, and of course, early on they had the whole Pale of Settlement, which was a huge section of land that they had given to them a long time ago.
Yeah, but it was given to them in the partition of Poland. It was actually a policy of Catherine the Great, as I said.
Right. All righty. We do have to go to a break. We will be right back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Herbal Healer Academy's new summer specials. Our 500 parts per million colloidal silver, all sizes on sale. Organic liquid iodine, liquid cal, Meg, vitamin D, CoQ10 with Hawthorne, colon enhancer, Super 2, natural laxative, our exceptional product, Connexin, memory power, and Super Male and Femplex. All on sale for the summer at herbalhealer.com. Also, 10% off on the HHA Survival Course. This is an important time to have this information. Might save your life. Nation's leader in supplying quality natural medicine and education. herbalhealer.com. Free online newsletter. Quality natural medicine supplier since 1988. We ship the same day you place your order. Free 128-page catalog with your first order. Go to herbalhealer.com today. herbalhealer.com.
Warning for all Gulf Coast disaster survivors. Be aware that dangerous gases are in the air you breathe. Benzene, hydrogen sulfide, methylene chloride, and Corexit 9500. Keep your body clean with micro plant powder. For all Gulf Coast residents and all who want to be healthy, hempusa.org brings you a new formulation of micro plant powder with lactobacillus acidophilus, rebuilding your immune system while detoxing the rest of your body, pulling out positive toxins, heavy metals, viruses, fungus, bacteria, and parasites. Cleans and purifies the blood, lungs, stomach, and colon. Micro plant powder will help eliminate these dangerous chemicals from the body used in the Gulf cleanup. At hempusa.org, we want you to try our number one selling detox product, micro plant powder. Call and order at 1-908-691-2608. 1-908-691-2608. Or visit us at hempusa.org today.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Today is Carl Rattle, the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is semiSemiticcontroversies.blogspot.com. And you were talking about Stalin and the fact that he wanted to give them a relatively large piece of property, Birbijan. And why was that? Did he want to keep Zionism internalized within the Russian state, or why did he want to do that?
Well, the reason Stalin wanted to do that was partially because we have to bear in mind that when this was proposed, Stalin was the Nationalities Commissar of the USSR. So he was the one responsible, as a Georgian, and in a sense a nationality himself, for dealing with corporate policy. And this policy followed a Leninist solution to the problem, whereby you would create lots and lots of little self-contained national groups who would then over time become, they'd be self-governing, and then they would over time be absorbed into this greater socialist world. But fairly early on after Lenin's death in 1927-1928, Stalin began to move away from this concept, because he was, I think, a true believer that in Marxism, insofar as its universalism went. So he believed that everyone was equal, that these ideas of nationality were nothing more than abstract constructs of the exploiting classes, and sort of going on from there. So he began to sort of move away from it, but he saw it still as a good propaganda project. And where, and of course, he recognized, as much as he may have deplored it otherwise, that the Jews were a force to be reckoned with in the world, and that they did have a lot of influence. And he didn't, and because you had so many Jews who were important members of the Communist Party, to give you a figure, the Large Soviet Encyclopedia in 1933, I do believe, in volume 34, or 28, I can't remember which, clearly states that one third of the Bolshevik Party organizational structure, as in its activist core, was Jewish. Now, that's a massive overrepresentation, particularly in an official Soviet encyclopedia.
Right.
One that's, you know, endorsed by Stalin, of course.
Now, what was their population percentage-wise in Russia? Like 1 or 2% or less?
More like 5, I should think. 5 to 10, possibly, if you're on the outside. But they were a major minority, but they were not... They weren't so large as to be able to have that kind of overrepresentation in the scale of the Communist Party itself. Because the common argument is, oh yes, they were overrepresented, but they're only a small amount of the party. Again, that's complete nonsense. Because although it was, to quote Orlando Figgs, only a small portion of the Jews accounted for a large portion of the Bolshevik Party, that fact itself tells us that we have to account for this. And there's an awful lot of literature either denying it or trying to account from it in terms of, oh, they were persecuted. So then if they were so persecuted, why did they become Bolsheviks? Why didn't they become various other things where they could have potentially also done the persecuting? A good example is the monarchists, and some of them did indeed become quite avid monarchists. So why did they become Bolsheviks? It's something that's quite difficult to answer from a kind of conventional point of view without sort of violating the rules of logic, because you end up citing yourself in many respects. It's a bit of circular reasoning on the part of those who defend Jews quite often. An interesting statistic I came across fairly recently is that a French communist visiting the Soviet Union in 1952, I do believe, or 59, I can't remember which, published in Soviet Russia Today the figure that something in the region of, out of, I can't remember how many intellectuals, something like 80,000 Soviet intellectuals, he'd been told that a quarter of them were Jews as late as that. Which gives some necessary context to the fact that Stalin is alleged to have gone after the Jews as late as 1948 to 1953, precisely because if he was going after the intellectuals, who bear in mind was his actual stated target, he would necessarily hit Jews disproportionately. And of course, one of the big ones he went after, when the big groups he went after, was the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, which had played a big role in the war, but also had the big links to Zionism in America, had visited the US, been received by President Truman, the mayor of New York. You know, you've got BZ Gold, you've got Ben-Zion Goldberg, who was Solomon Mikhail's, and people like that, people who Stalin went after precisely because of their links with Zionism worldwide, and the fact that they were beginning quietly in their own way to talk about not socialism as the future, but Zionism. And that's very interesting. It's a lack of context. People cite the figures and they don't explain the context to Stalin's attack on intellectuals. Now, that's not to say Stalin wasn't being paranoid particularly, because he was. He was a very paranoid and generally genocidal lunatic in many respects.
Right.
But he had, in some ways, he had a point there. Just because he did some absolutely horrific things does not mean he was not the conspiracies and the plots that he saw were not necessarily not true. It just means that Stalin thought they were true, that we should be a bit careful, but not necessarily that they're not true in of themselves. And of course, in the 1960s, you have the publication of the seminal work of Soviet anti-Zionism, Kilochko's Judaism Without Embellishment, which is a fairly vicious attack on Judaism by any standards. But it's also a very factual one, ironically enough, written by a professor of history in the Soviet Union at the time. One that has been, I believe, has been reprinted in English, but I haven't been able to find a copy of it as of yet, so I don't speak Russian, fortunately.
So going back to the protocols.
Okay.
You indicate that, well, I hope that people have read the you have several parts. You have, seven parts. And there, some of what we believe typically are myths and just downright lies. And you've kind of segregated these into facts and really, so many people think that the protocols were an absolute agenda of what was going to happen, which you point out in the first part. And why can we just kind of, abandon that kind of a thought?
We can abandon that precisely because of the protocol's origins and the text itself. Bear in mind that the text is, that the text commonly used to suggest that is a, it includes numerous redactions, additions, and we've got some fairly major changes, and as well as mistranslations in the text. I mean, an example is the famous Nietzsche, Marx, and Darwin quote. That has nothing to do with the protocols originally itself. In fact, it was in the it was in the translator's note in the 1904 edition, which was put in the encyclopedic work by Lutuchensky, which said, like, the translator's note literally says, when it's talking about rationalism, it says, like Nietzsche, Marx, and Darwin. Then Nihilus then adds that into the text, I can't remember which protocol, as our agents, Nietzsche, Marx, and Darwin. So you've got a situation where things are being taken away, put back. I mean, it's just, and also it doesn't make sense if you think about it. If you have a traditional logic going on, then Nietzsche doesn't become really famous until the early 20th century. He's largely obscure until that point. So then why would he, if the text is what it says it is, well, supposedly anyway, what it is, from the 1880s or the early 1890s, why does it reference Nietzsche? And why does it reference Marx? Because Marx, again, doesn't come into prominence. He only comes into prominence later. Because Marx in his own lifetime was a failure. He was a revolutionary intellectual. And it was only after his death in 1881, when Engels began to really push his work and got it accepted by the German Social Democratic Party, which then allowed Marx's work to be accepted by the Russians, and then became, of course, that came to the attention of Jews and so forth, and the situation where that sort of interaction begins to occur. So again, you can't really have that. But also, it's things like the famous quote saying, undermining cities with subterranean tunnels. That's a mistranslation of a Russian concept. All it basically means is we are undermining your civilization, or we're sort of borrowing under it. It's a kind of Russian metaphor. But someone's mistranslated it literally and said, we are going to blow up your cities by putting subway tunnels under it. And of course, the anti-protocols literature has commonly interpreted that in terms of anti-modernism. So opposition to technology, opposition to subways, and so forth. In fact, as Demichelis has pointed out, it's actually a misquote. It's a mistranslation in the start. But also, the fact we can date it to 1901 to 1903 tells us that it's not, that it comes from a very specific point in time, and that the only direct, shall we say, quotes come from the Judenstaat, Herzl's the Judenstaat again. All the other issues tend to resolve themselves once we understand that the issue of the editions. So you've got all these editions being published between 1903 and 1906 particularly. So you have about seven to eight different editions with different texts added, taken away during this time. and you have a situation where you can't really go to the, you can't really use any of these additions other than to suggest that, as Demichelis and Taguilev have done, that we've got a situation where there is an original document in one or two of these, behind one or two of these texts. So someone somewhere has created the original document, and then this document has been slightly altered to be published by Krushevan, and it's suggested by in addition to two of the anonymous editions that we have from 1905. So you have anonymous one, anonymous two, published at different times during that year. And what indicates is this is not a conspiracy as such. It's also the title. The title is not, per se, The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. What it is, what the actual, it better translates as, is the protocols of the wise philosophers of Zion. So it's a work of political philosophy. It is not a work of, you know, a conspiratorial work. It's just, it's suggesting this is our ideas, our policy concepts that we are going to implement. And this is not a Sanhedrin talking, because if you look at the text, it does not read like a Sanhedrin. There's no Talmudic quotes or anything. But it does read like a Zionist text, precisely because of the third person, the Jews, a very, very common way for Zionists to express their point, a way Herzl himself expresses it. And a religious Jew, which a member of the Sanhedrin would necessarily be, would express it in terms of Israel, literally the biological community of Israel, of, you know, the children of Israel and so forth. That's how they talked. But Zionist Jews tended to be in opposition to that, because their main opposition at this particular time was among the very, very religious Jews. So instead, they talked of themselves in the German way of speaking, as in, they took themselves as Juden, as Jews, rather than members of Israel or Yehudi, as Jews tend to refer, as the religious Jews tend to refer to themselves as.
Now, so it's more of a Zionist document than a Judaic document. And yep. Why is that important that we distinguish that?
Because because Zionism is not the be-all and end-all of Jews. Zionism is merely the latest form of Jewish ideology. But we have to bear in mind that at the same time this is being written, there are many different solutions to what the Jews saw as their problems being propounded. You've got assimilationism, of which Marxism and anarchism were frequently adopted, which is, again, jumps into Stalin and his, and why so many Jews were so keen on him and his ideas. And we also have, of course, Zionism, but we also have the highly religious Jews who were talked about being separate, you know, waiting for the Messiah to turn up. But again, you've got the problem of that Zionist Jews and religious Jews don't tend to actually, they don't disagree on fundamentals, they just disagree on the time scale. So religious Jews believe the Messiah will come and lead them to Israel and they will rule the world when the Messiah turns up. The Zionism basically asserts we will go there anyway and we'll rule the world regardless. And you get various combinations in between. You also get liberals who say, okay, we can be Jews, we can have a religious Jewish ideology within a liberal context. You get conservatives, and you have a whole mishmash of them. Because if you stress too much, it's religious versus Zionism, then you kind of lose the competing atmosphere that is so common to Jewish society throughout history. You have many wars that go on between different figures. A good example again is Damascus Affair. You had Moses Montefiore, a British Jew and banker, versus Adolf Kremer. They had a massive fight in Damascus all the way in Damascus and around Alexandria, and then all the way back again, and then for years afterwards. And you have these sort of situations where they're fighting each other, and it's very, very hard to see it as a kind of plan, as a plan in terms of a centralized idea. But if it's the ideology of a group like the extreme Zionist sects, then it kind of makes sense that a lot of the ideas that they're pounding are from their opposition's literature. They're talking about about gold and how we can manipulate the world. And ideas like that directly derive from the Jews' own understanding of, for example, the Rothschilds and the Goldschmidts of the Warburgs and so forth. That these people were famous in the Jewish world for having, for manipulating nations to the Jewish cause. And this is the kind of thinking we're dealing with. We're dealing with a group of people who think that because they're Jews, they can do this, but at the same time, they're not in a position to do it. Because if they're in a position to do it, they would not be writing down a lot of these ideas, and they certainly wouldn't have allowed them to have been published.
Oh, that's a profound thought. Certainly. And of course, I don't think that the Rothschilds really accepted Zionism until basically until after World War I, even though one of the Rothschilds actually had some colonies down in Palestine, which he kind of ruled with an iron fist. All righty. We've got a break right now. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
If you're the mother of a child with behavior problems, I'd like to talk to you. My name is Janet Lehman. I'm a behavioral therapist and a mom. I know what it's like when the child you love becomes a defiant, out-of-control child who disrespects you. That's why my husband James and I created the Total Transformation, the program that tens of thousands of moms are now using to turn around their child's behavior. If you've heard about the Total Transformation and wondered if it will work for you, now you can try it for free. I'm willing to give away 1,000 programs today for free. All you need to do is get the program and let us know how it works for you. We'll let you keep it for free. I know the Total Transformation works because I used these techniques with my own son and with troubled kids for over 30 years. Let me prove to you that it works by giving you the program for free.
Call now. 1-800-583-1093. 1-800-583-1093. That's 1-800-583-1093.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcasts, as well as a contest corner where we'll raffle different prizes to our listeners. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. All righty. The Rothschilds really didn't take an interest in Zionism until after World War, or during the late part of World War I, correct?
That's true. They certainly didn't take a massive interest in it. They were very interested in Jewish causes, but until the end of World War One, the Palestine came under a British mandate after having been taken from the Ottoman Empire in the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916, it wasn't really accessible to them. They wanted it. They wanted to negotiate for it. But getting it would be very, very difficult and very, very costly. But with the British in charge and the French in charge in Syria and the Lebanon and so forth, you had a situation where it was possible for the Jews to begin to go into Palestine and to begin to try and take it back, as they regard it, take it back anyway, and kind of get rid of the inhabitants over time. Yeah, I noticed what you said when you said that the Rothschilds ruled the Palestinian, their little area, rather brutally. In fact, there's a quote from the Judenstadt that's quite interesting in that regard. It says it's right in the introduction to the Judenstadt when Herzl says, "In the world as it is now, and for an indefinite period, will probably remain might precedes right." And compare that to Protocol 1, which says, "In the beginnings of the structure of society, they were subjected to brutal and blind force, afterwards to law, which is the same force, only disguised. I draw the conclusion that by the law of nature, right lies in force." Now, those two things are saying exactly the same thing in many respects. They're just literally, all that the protocols are doing is saying it a slightly different way, but the meaning is precisely the same. It's the kind of thing where the Jews are allowed to do anything they like. When you talk about the Rothschild project, but there is an awful long history of attempts at Zionism in various forms. Possibly the most interesting was one undertaken by a Spanish Jew who'd become a duke at Spanish court via being a very in quotes good friend, or actually a banker and a kind of agent to to Ferdinand and Isabella. Now, what happened to him was that he left in very dubious circumstances, aka he ran off with a lot of money, following the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. Was it 1489? I can't remember which. Was it two?
Yes.
It was following the LaGuardia ritual murder case anyway. But he then went to Constantinople. And during his time in Spain, he'd been appointed as the Duke of Naxos. And then he went to the Ottoman Empire. He didn't convert to Islam, but he converted to Ottoman ways, shall we say.
All righty. We do have to cut to our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back after station ID.